Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to some incredibly interesting and inspiring women. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Daisy Buchanan. Hello, and thank you for your time today. Hi.
Hello, Nikki. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Pleasure. Thank you so much. Now, Daisy is an award-winning journalist and author, a podcast host, and a successful book inspector and a TEDx speaker, and Grazia's former agony aunt. So, wow, you have done so much, and all in the middle of moving house and everything else, and you're in a booth in Margate, and I'm at home in East Anglia. But let's start with your success as a podcast host yourself. You're not just a podcast host. You are the number one iTunes podcast host with Your Booked, Aren't You, which is the name of your podcast. Congratulations. And how did you get to number one?
It's all to do with, I think, Apple's very complicated algorithms. So it's a mystery to me still, but we've been making it now for, gosh, I think it's the very end of 2018 we started. So me trying to work out what year it is or what day it is after the mad, 18 months we've just had, that's very complicated. But I think we've been at it now for 2.5 years, and it's very much sort of, it's quite organic and homemade. My husband, Dale Shaw, producer Dale, also a writer, but he is, he's made podcasts for the BBC, and he does lots of audio. So we sort of had the idea together. Your Booked was a very silly pun, really. And I thought of it in the shower. I was a huge fan of The Adam and Joe Show. And obviously, Adam Buxton is one of the most successful podcasts the world has ever known. I love his podcast a lot. But on The Adam and Joe Show, they had a segment called Vinyl Justice, where Adam and Joe would put on joke shop policemen's helmets, go to pop stars' houses, and inspect their record collection.
Oh,
and I thought, oh, you could do one for books and call it Your Book, like Your Book, like Your Nicked, which is not a pun that anyone ever responds to or cares about. But it brings me lots of private satisfaction.
But it's witty, isn't it? Yes.
Well, I mean, what I really hope to do was talk about books as very tactile objects and books as things that bring us so much comfort. And I'm a reader and I love reading. And I think that especially in social media times, God, listen to me. sounds bad, thousand years old.
It's so true. We are in social media times.
But often when we talk about books, we can make them sound quite grand and dry and difficult. And I love to be challenged by a book, but also, the thing that I think of often is, say, one of my favourite writers of all time is Marion Keyes, and I think she's wonderful, and I think she's finally being recognised as the giant of literature that she is and the expert in human emotions that she is. But growing up reading her, there was a real like, oh, well, you ought to be reading Tolstoy and Dickens, but, Marion Keyes, just a bit of fun. And actually, I've never, ever, ever reread any Tolstoy or Dickens. I read Rachel's Holiday every single year. And so that was really what I hoped to do, was have conversations about books as things that just soothe us and support us and bring us so much. And reading is, I think, the most nourishing thing we can do for ourselves, and not have escape the idea that it's like grand hobby. And I worry that, I think reading should be the most inclusive thing. I know, obviously, literacy is something to be concerned about, and books are things that can be bought. As a writer of books, it makes me very happy when people buy them.
Well, we're going to come on and talk about that. I'm so excited for your books and for your podcast, Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers, which I love that, who would like the chance to snoop around their favourite author's bookshelves. And it's a bit like, a sweeping statement, a bit like that through the keyhole, isn't it, in terms of through the book. So you find out what's on people's bookshelves, which is very revealing, isn't it? And why people borrow books and never give them back. So what's on your bookshelf then?
Oh, gosh. It's been interesting being in the throes of moving house and packing books away. In lockdown, I discovered the writer Laurie Colwin. I don't know if you've come across her. American writer, very sadly died just before she was 50. A very influential food writer. Nigella Lawson is a huge fan. Another of my favourite writers, Catherine Heine, who wrote the brilliant Early Morning Rise that came out last year. She's a huge fan. And My friend, a lovely friend, Gail, who is a bookseller at the London Review of Books bookshop, gave me a copy of Happy All the Time by Laurie Colwyn as a birthday gift. And I've got to say, the cover of that edition is not enormously prepossessing, and it's a bit painterly and a bit greyed out. And I thought, oh, I know it's called Happy All the Time. And then eventually I was like, oh, God, I really need to read this because I, you know, need to thank Gail. And Gail had also just recommended another wonderful book called Business as Usual. And I will have to look up the author's. But it's a tiny, tiny, tiny press, I think called Handheld Press. And it's that Business as Usual is a reissued book from the 30s about a young girl making her way in London and sort of having a gap year, but working in a bookshop at a department store. Anyway, so I thought, well, Gail never steers me wrong. I will try this Happy All the Time and see. And I read it in a day. And as soon as I finished the last page, I just wept because it was happy and glorious. And I was just so sad to leave these people. And it was so...
Wow. Oh, I need to read that. And we all need to be happy all the time at the moment because there's a lot of miserable people about, aren't there, in terms of, you know, we're all really struggling.
This, because I don't know, you know, when people will listen to this, but at the time of recording, we're in that very, very strange time when Monday is Freedom Day. And I don't want to... be polarizing because I know that means so many things to so many people. But I think in a weird way, in the throes of it, when we were all locked down, I don't think we ever got used to it, but we sort of learned a way of coping and of keeping things very simple. But I think it was really, really hard and challenging mentally. But I think this is absolutely as hard in a different way. It's quite overwhelming.
Right. You're so right. The coming out of it. And we're all feeling guilty. Why should we feel bad coming out of it? But actually, it's a really sunny day today. And I'm sorry we've got us hunkering down in our little booths. But literally, I was remembering that it was so sunny. It was like a holiday at the beginning. You know, actually, it was a bit of a comfort to just be able to read and sit in the sunshine and a bit of a holiday and nest with your children or whatever like I did. But actually, now we're all just thinking, oh, we're so tired and so confused and so overwhelmed. Yes, Freedom Day might feel a bit of a damp squib, mightn't it, in terms of are we feeling free?
I don't know what this is or why it should be. Having a very full diary makes me anxious, and I'm self-employed, and I think it's a failing of mine, and I think I need structure and routine, and I need to embrace structure and routine, but feeling as though I've always got about 12 things ahead of me, like on Monday, but I know I've got some, I'm doing something on Monday night, but I couldn't tell you what it is.
And
just that sense of pressure.
I think we're all the same because we've become more anxious in lockdown, and I think we've got used to having a quieter, slower life. And now too much is just makes us anxious because there's too much to think about or too much to do. It's almost overwhelm, isn't it? To that's, you know, sensory deprivation that we had when we were in it. Now we're sort of, oh, I don't think I can quite cope with going out more than a couple of times a week or whatever. It's
truly, we've become like moles underground, or like we've all been in a cult and been released.
We all have. But you've got a lovely podcast there and some amazing guests and writers and authors who support you. But journalism shaped your fiction writing. You started as an intern and went on to be features desk at the Fun Teen Bliss magazine, which started you being more aware of those sort of youth topics, didn't it, in terms of sex and body issues and supporting young women, liberating them, really, wasn't it?
Definitely. I feel so lucky to have started in magazines at Bliss because I think we felt so, so strongly that we had a deep, deep duty of care to our readers, and they were the ones we were writing for, and they set the tone. And I do think that things in glossy magazine land have really changed dramatically over the last 2 years, and I love writing for magazines, and I'm such a fan of them. Of course, I grew up reading them. You know, I still remember I was about 13 or 14 buying my first ever Elle, and it felt so weighty and so significant. And wow, the idea that I was
were sophisticated.
Well, I felt very sophisticated. Naturally, I should say, I aspired to love Vogue, but Elle, the features were so much better, and I just adored those brilliant personal essays. And that was, I think, the first, like, you know, oh, actually, I think I love fashion, but this is what I really, really love is the writing. But definitely, there was no sense of at Bliss, we are going to tell readers what our trends are. We are going to inform them. They were leading the way. And we were just trying so hard to make a magazine that was useful for them, that reflected their lives. And I think as well, it was a time when, so I started Bliss in about 2008, and the internet was going, but so we didn't really quite have social media as we know it now, but we were increasingly aware that young girls were finding information from all sorts of places and lots of kind of scary, unverified places. And we knew we couldn't shy away from anything explicit, but equally we had a big responsibility to present it in a way that didn't frighten anyone and didn't inform people, and that they felt they could come and ask questions. And
trust you.
I think it made me kind. I think that there were, I don't know if you'd agree with this, but I feel like there was definitely a period in the media and in the world. And now I know we're having so many conversations about kindness and how to do it and what it means. And I think there are examples of the best and worst of humanity. But there was just, I feel like, a period when I was a teenager and quite impressionable, where it was just really fashionable to be a bit sneery and a bit mean. And you'd say things like, oh, she's fat. No one would, you know, think at all that might be a problem. And I think that I really hope, certainly, my work at Bliss made me write as a kind person. There have definitely been times when I failed to do that, and I've, you know, sneered and made jokes and tried to impress, and I've, you know, gone back and sort of felt ashamed of that. And I'm always learning and growing and evolving. But I do think that's the most important thing to bring to any creative thing a person does, that kindness.
Definitely. And I've read that you said that you knew the readers would be taking everything to heart and you wanted everything to feel kind. And I think, as you say, you know, that kindness is so important now, because I think everyone is oversensitive now and reacting to things they wouldn't normally react to. And I've interviewed people before that specialise in trauma counselling on here, and they've said that, you know, every trauma reminds you of all your previous traumas, and some people have roomfuls of traumas like dominoes. And I think that's what everyone has to be sensitive with, isn't it? They don't know what everyone else is dealing with. And you were Grazia Agony aunt as well, weren't you? What were the main agonies when you worked on that? Are they always the same sorts of thing? It's about body image and relationships and things they're troubled with.
I really was expecting people to write in about their love lives, but it was predominantly work, I think. Obviously, people wrote about, you know, troubles with families and with partners, but that real anxiety about just never feeling good enough, never feeling like you're going to make it, sort of giving everything and everything to, you know, ambition and not ambition. I think even now there's still a slight disconnect. We think, oh, ambition, it's the Gourney Weaver and working girl, you know, spa and being a real cow. And actually, no, it's just feeling that it's exactly the same, I think, as when, you know, we were at school. And I think that the pressure to sort of, you know, get A stars and be top and not in a way that sort of like a proud thing. I remember, you know, when I was at school, I went to a very sort of academic girls' school. There was lots of lovely things about being there, and I was really lucky. But, and I loved English. I was going to say, obviously, maybe not obviously, I don't know. And I did well at that. And that didn't seem to be something I really had to sort of strain for. But there was no part of me that's like, oh, I'm good at English. I'm not good at science. That's fine. I just don't have an aptitude for one of those things. You know, I'll do my best, but I won't, you know, absolutely burn myself out trying. No, I have to be perfect at everything. And if I'm not so good at something else, that's a flaw that must be corrected. And that was very much the attitude all around me, all of these young girls.
It
breaks my heart now. And I think we bring that to work because there's no one to stop us. I do wonder whether there's a slight generational difference, perhaps. I graduated, it was a year before I started at Bliss, so sort of into a recession. And I think there was a time, because I've got, you know, a brilliant friends, like women who are in their sort of 40s, 50s, 60s, like, I don't understand why, you know, we all just like went to an ashram, we had a lovely time, we just didn't really care until we were 30. And, you know, then our mate gave us a job on a magazine and it's all great. Yeah, I think it was the anxiety. I certainly felt that I didn't really have any hopefulness about me in my 20s. I always felt as though disaster was around the corner. And I think part of that is me, but I do think that part of that was coming, really being hot-housed and then coming out into this sort of complicated cultural landscape where there just was this sense of absolute scarcity everywhere.
Well, I think that's still common now, you know, being a parent of teenagers myself and seeing their friends and their troubles at university. I think that self-confidence and self-belief is a huge thing, if not worse now than ever. And in fact, you know, this podcast is about chatting to women about their work-life mantras and influences, but about setbacks they've overcome and how we help others, because navigating those waters, you know, between your 20s and 30s and thinking that you should do this by then and pressure on you if you haven't and why and guilt. And then that goes on, you know, to when you are a parent and everything else. And you wanted to talk about, you know, you've touched on that anxiety around your work. But I think that's a really important thing to discuss to help other women, because I don't think men feel quite the same as women at work. In terms of the way they have to feel the best at everything. Would you say that?
I think there might be something there, definitely. I was talking to a friend the other day about her leaving her workplace, and she was saying, you know, it's very lovely and very progressive in lots of ways, but there was a white man who was employed really doing the same thing or a very similar thing at a very similar level to sort of other, you know, female colleagues, and, you know, one was a woman of colour, and the white man was getting paid like not even like a couple of thousand, or like a huge bump. And that workplace was somewhere that would have described itself as being very, you know, progressive and open, and, you know, it wasn't a sort of big shouty bank. I don't know, because I've been self-employed for so long. I think when I think of proper offices in my head, I'm imagining like the stock market. But and I think that there is, no one will, a lot of this sort of, you know, the sexism, unconscious bias and things that hold us back still, they're all so endemic and so enmeshed and so sort of such a big cultural trap that I don't think men realise at all.
I think they're
not. Why things are easier for them than they are for women. I don't think they realise, say, when they're just promoting their mates or, you know, they don't, because you don't notice the freedom you have when you move around with it.
I think you're right. And, you know, I've been to conferences on that. And, you know, obviously equality and diversity is massively improving. But in terms of, I think people tend to hire people that are similar to them because they feel comfortable. And I don't think they're doing it intentionally, but it's just what makes them feel in their comfort zone. And it's just having that awareness, isn't it? But in terms of anxiety, you were anxious in terms of self-doubt and panic in your own job. And actually that led, and I saw you wrote an amazing article in Grazia with your Honest Open, that led to you leaving your job and feeling empowered that it wasn't right for you. And people, do you want to talk about that and how people shouldn't feel bad if something doesn't feel right?
Of course, the job in question was my dream job. I thought I just turned 30 and I had been self-employed for, gosh, coming up to 3 years maybe. And I think that the start of that period was really giddy and dizzying, and so many opportunities were coming my way, and it was totally different from, you know, working for a magazine and, you know, being a bit more anonymous, really not earning very much money, and it all just, you know, being thinking, oh, I just want to get a bit more money at a different magazine is all I could hope for. So I was, you know, drunk on it, really. Everything coming where I was constantly in a state of just
euphoria,
huge adrenaline bumps and euphoria. But then, you know, if I didn't get to I remember at one point thinking, and I was doing quite a lot for The Guardian, and that was really exciting, you know, things sort of national newspapers and magazines. And I felt like I needed to get something in, some sort of a national, like every day, like if it was down to 3 pieces a week, I was slipping, I was failing. So I was really, really beating myself up. And I do think that is a kind of, it's an addiction. And that is an addiction that society tolerates and validates and encourages. So this place where I'd really thought, you know, when I was a teenager, this is where I want to work. Oh my goodness, this is it. You know, it was like the feeling in my head that the mean girls at school who'd always bullied me was suddenly like, be friends, come sit at our table, come have lunch with us. And there was lots of stuff that I brought to that job. It was very much about, you know, my own insecurity. And I think I was primed for what happened to happen. I was really frustrated because all I wanted to do was write, and, you know, that wasn't really what I was hired for. And I know I missed it. I missed it badly. And I think that if it wasn't for my mental illness, I would have quite quickly gone, oh, I'm sorry, I've got this wrong, it's not right, thank you for the opportunity, let's leave it. But I sort of, there's a Brené Brown quote I love, and I might be about to fudge it, but it's something like, stop looking, going through the world looking for reasons why you don't belong. And that's all I did every day. I just sat there and waited for someone to shout at me and fire me. And the other shock was, as someone who was a workaholic and working, really just, you know, abusing that and trying to do as much as I could all the time. In that role, there were quite a lot of very quiet periods, and you know, the nature of things meant there wasn't really as much to do. And I just felt absolutely just paralyzed with guilt and shame of sort of, you know, being horribly inactive. And it didn't help as well. There was someone who was hired almost exactly the same time as me, and her job was sort of equivalent to mine, or there was, in terms of kind of the hierarchy, what we did, there was, it's hard to differentiate between who did what. And this person, for whatever reason, you know, wanted to freeze me out, wouldn't speak to me, wouldn't include me in things. I was really trying so hard to be friendly. I assumed it was all my fault. I just sort of tried harder. You know, at meetings, they would shut down sort of every single one of my ideas. And, you know, I think I just started to doubt myself entirely as a writer, as someone who could do that. And now I know, you know, I will, in the event of an apocalypse, I'll be writing with a stick in the ground. I can't stop myself, even if no one wants to read what I write. You know,
they certainly do as an award winner. But my goodness, what, you know, that's very humiliating and heartbreaking. And I think that's very honest to say that, you know, when you're in your 30s and you thought it was your dream and your dream turned into a nightmare. And I think even some of the people I've interviewed before saying that evidence-based, you know, if you think something's going really wrong, you look for validation as to why everything's going wrong and you self-blame and self-guilt. And actually to turn that around and to think, actually it's not me, maybe it's their insecurities, or maybe they're jealous or envious or threatened, or, you know, competitive, and actually to find a way out of that, because it's very hard. And as you say, I think probably it only comes when you look back, that to say actually this isn't for me. And people don't, they just slump, don't they? And to share that with others who are probably finding that in lockdown, that humiliation, that being frozen out, but not belonging. Everyone wants that sense of connection and belonging that maybe they used to have and now they haven't got. It's a struggle. So the fact you've come out of that is brilliant, and tips for
thank others. You so much. And I really want to be very clear that this was, you know, 6 years ago, and it took me a long time. And, you know, the thing is, I left that job really feeling, you know, wobbly and awful. And then it was, you know, I, at the end of that year, sort of, you know, lots of very positive and exciting things happened. And it really, you could do a sort of real Alan Partridge, like, well, needless to say, I had the last laugh. But I would have said, you know, that wasn't it. I don't want that to be the story.
I felt vulnerable. Always feeling, yes, you feel vulnerable, you feel humiliated, all of those awful feelings that remind us of, you know, growing up or childhood or whatever. It's, I don't think, you know, I think that actually that's a good thing to share for others to know that it's okay to feel like that sometimes, and to work through the why and the how, and to know that we're exactly in this world where we're meant to be at this precise moment, aren't we? And actually, if that didn't fit and you got out of it, then look what's happened since. And who, yes, as you say, Alan Partridge would say, who's laughing now? So, you know, you got through that, and mental health is everywhere right now.
And well, I suppose I didn't.
Anyone who isn't challenged.
I'm not sure how much of this I'm allowed to tell you, but I will, because I've finished my next novel today.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, exciting.
And it is very much about the world of work and ambition and the absolute mental grip it has on us all, and what it is to give everything you think you have to a sort of career and this, you know, hope for validation, and then find out that maybe that's not a way to live, and it's sort of, it's only going to make me unhappy. There are lots of jokes in it too, I hope.
Oh, so live to work or work to live. Oh, well, we'll have to talk to you on a separate podcast about your new one, because we've talked about the fact you were a workaholic and a passionate, you quoted, is it pronounced Poindexter? I had to look up that word, because I've never heard that before. That's actually a real word. A nerdy need to people please, and a moral sense you should always try your best and go and be above and beyond what's expected of you. Is that the correct pronunciation? And that's what you thought you were. What a great word.
I think
I'm a very sad long-term Simpsons fan, and I think Poindexter is my favourite Simpsons insult. I think Nelson.
Oh, I never heard that.
It's a good one. Yeah, I'm sure. Though,
isn't it? Yes, you're such a Poindexter. People have to look it up.
And now you know it. You can use it. You know.
Yes, now I know it. I'm going to, yes, accuse people of being them. No, good for you for owning up. So work... as you'll come on with your next book, you know, explaining that it's the most toxic, complicated love affair, as you've said, that we have. But let's talk about you writing. You're an author of nonfiction books, How to Be a Grown-Up and The Sisterhood, with praise from high-profile writers. But your first actual novel came out earlier this year, even though you've written another one already, unbelievably. The New Voice of Contemporary Fiction, Filthy and Funny. So the message, the story that hasn't been told before, what was your thinking behind this message?
I guess with Insatiable, I've always been fascinated by couples and their relationship and how little we know. And one of my favourite books is Look at Me by Anita Bruckner. And that's about a young woman who has a friendship with a very, very glamorous couple and wants their approval and wants their validation. And in Look at Me, it never becomes sexual. There are certain undertones, but nothing is ever made explicit. And I think I first read Look at Me when I was a teenager, and I thought, if I'm allowed to say this on this podcast.
Yes.
Where's what if they're all shagging? I think they should be shagging. And yes. I think that's it. So I'd had a really bad breakup, and I remember being at the supermarket with two of my friends who are in a couple, and they were in the middle of this argument that it wasn't like a serious thing. It was just, you know, being grumpy and sulky, and someone, you know, saying, fine, I'll go off and get the loo roll myself then, or whichever. And I just thought, you know, the security of that. And I was with someone who would never, ever, ever be clear about how they felt about me. And, you know, I just felt really sort of wrong-footed and foolish. And I thought, oh my goodness, all I want in the world is to be. And, it, you know, it wasn't that I fancied my friends or anything, but I thought, I want to be part of this.
Yes, exactly, part of this negative dynamic.
But this glorious security. And that's, I suppose, what I wanted to explore about taking someone at a very tender time, and that what in Insatiable Violet is doing is she thinks she's pursuing something very sort of wild and exciting, and she's really pushing her boundaries. But actually what she thinks she wants is this security. And Lottie and Simon, the couple, you know, seem to be offering her both of those things until it all becomes quite dramatically unraveled.
Well, so actually that you created that whilst you're standing in the supermarket in terms of the thought process, didn't you? With the normality of the situation. And it's about women's desire, aspiration and vulnerability, as you say, the lust, longing and need to be loved, which we all have, particularly in this crazy world, and find satisfaction, obviously, in all senses of the world. And we'll get you to read some non-racy parts in a minute. But you raised the discussion that sex was another thing that we felt as women that we had to be good at, you know, to be desired. We want more. We want better friends, better job, better homes, better sex. We want to be the best wife, the best mother, the best work. You know, we'd put a lot of pressure on ourselves, don't we? But this smooth, described as smoothly observant, brilliantly, giddily filthy, how about that for an accolade, billed as a love story for greedy girls. And some publishers didn't know what to make of it. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall when you saw some of the publishers' faces. So you showed it to your husband. What did he make of it then?
Well, I'll never forget, because I had gone away on a writing retreat to write something else. I was meant to be working on the sisterhood, but I just got this idea. And it just sort of started pouring out of me. And it was a little bit different at the beginning. And it was immediately filthy. And I sent it to my husband. And I was, you know, away from home at this point. And he said, it's very sexy. And I'm like, yeah, it's really rude, isn't it? I don't think anyone would ever publish that. I'm really sorry. So it's like, he said, no, it's sexy. And that was when I thought I might be onto something. Because to write about, because it's such a subjective thing, isn't it? We all like to read about different things, and we all like to see different things, and thinking, is this going to chime with anyone? But and also wanting to do both as well, to have a book that doesn't shy away from that. Because I think I definitely read books as well that
certainly not shy. So it's a cocktail of shocking and tender, raunchy, and I won't go into too much of the detail that you cover. But you it's good you're portraying whether you were running towards your future or away from your past. I thought that was a really interesting message for people to sort of reflect on as well. That was one of the lines that I'd read.
I think we've all sort of felt that way at times, maybe, that we are, it's really difficult, I think, when one is, you know, feeling anxious, and especially right now, when I think, how can any of us run towards the future? Because we have absolutely no idea what that looks like. And so, I mean, an unsexy example is, finally, we moved house, buying a house the very, 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 very first time. It's really taken since November, and right around Easter, it all looked like it was all going to fall apart. And that worry, you know, it was really odd to not be able to imagine my life because I didn't know where I'd be living. And it's just hard to think.
Especially when you need to write somewhere that makes you feel, you know, how you should be to write.
Exactly. Like, what will I see when I look out of the window? And yes. I don't know. So not knowing, sort of say, like, oh, you know, when I go to the shops, which way will I go? And that sounds so like such a tiny thing, but it's really, it's, you know, this is the cushion that sews together the fabric of anyone's universe. And
that's so true. That's so brilliant. Yes, I love the way you speak in words, because you are a writer, but that's so true. And I think it's worse for the control freaks, isn't it, to not be able to plan the future, because I think the people that are coping best are the ones that just change their plans, live by the day, very easygoing, not so bothered. I think everyone needs to almost become like that, or they just get too stressed out. So this Seismic Sexy book has been overdue for the Instagram generation that you have touched on, giving them a sexual revolution, because although readers in their 20s and 30s have a wealth of information online about sex and beyond, they feel anxious too about their body image, and they don't feel how you want this book to make everyone feel.
Well, what I really wanted to write about so much was desire. And I feel like all I ever do when I'm on lovely podcasts, and it's lovely to do it, and I'm always so excited to have the opportunity, I always bang on about Jilly Cooper. I adore Jilly Cooper beyond yes. all sense. And what meant so history. Much to me.
Yeah, she was ahead of her time though, wasn't she? You know,
her books growing up, it wasn't just the sex, it was that the heroines really wanted it, and they thought about it before it happened. And they would, you know, you've got lots of women just going to parties and feeling a bit awkward, but also being, you know, desperate to get up with someone, and curious and excited and all of that. And sometimes I think that now, you know, and certainly I don't want to get too much into the Love Island weeds, but I feel like that's not maybe wholly accurate, but there are lots of sort of things in that area where all I see is women who know exactly how to be desired, and they want to be desired, but I miss seeing, and of course, you know, you see agency and they talk about people being, you know, fish and some of that, but just that absolute mad giddy wanting and craving, I really wanted to put some of that on the page, and to write it for the people who, I'll have to write it for, you know, women like me who are going to get near Love Island anytime soon.
And who want to express this raising. And obviously, yes, writing it on a retreat was the way to go. And also the realities of some of the awkwardness you've said, you know, and how your body allows you to escape in your mind. And post-lockdown, I'm sure there'll be like roaring 20s type liberation parties, won't they? But we were going to, if you've got a little bit on your phone, I was going to go to a non-racy bit, but more of a sort of how women feel, almost envying other women, on page 8 there, if you've got it on your phone, please. Because I just think that puts us into the eye of, sometimes we look in awe of others and we might not know the whole story, as you say.
I often feel as though I'm constantly, anxiously making an effort, even though failure is inevitable. I'm the human version of a smudged, crumpled maths exam paper. The result is never quite right, but at least I'm showing my working. This woman is a walking right answer. She looks as though she's never made a mistake in her life. I'm not sure that she has ever sweated. She's a beautiful, stylish person in a room filled with beautiful, stylish people, but it's her confidence that is captivating. Even my mother would grudgingly say she holds herself very well. Somehow I don't think she learned this with a book balanced on her head. It's as though she's standing properly because she knows she owes it to her bones. Her feet are hip-width apart, her weight spread evenly across them. I become aware of my own body, the way I'm slouching to the left, with my right foot grinding a smear of mayonnaise into the parquet floor. Immediately, I stop and stand, as if called to attention. This is someone who is in charge of both her feet at all times. Even in a room full of power players, she has a noticeable aura. She has reached the next level of self-possession.
I love that. And I love the way you've written it and the way you tell the story. And I always think it's so comforting hearing, particularly an author about their own book, you know, telling a story. And it really draws you in. Thank you for that.
Oh, thank you so much for having me read it. It was a pleasure.
No, it's lovely. And actually how women are often in awe of other women, or again, it makes them self-doubt themselves. And I remember it sounds massively showy, but I'll never forget. I used to be in the film industry and I'd gone to this penthouse cocktail party in the south of France with the TV industry. And I got out of the lift, and as I came into the party, I had flat shoes on and clothes that just seemed way too frumpy. And I looked up and Cindy Crawford was standing towering above me with this letterbox smile, and just everything I was wearing and feeling felt exactly how you described it, was just not like she was. And she just looked like a goddess. And it was just a really strange feeling, but one that women have about other women, isn't it? In terms of, wow, just bizarre.
What a moment. And I know I've been in that position, not in that amazing position before. I've been in, you know, a penthouse in the south of France with Cindy Crawford, but just almost looking behind me and thinking, surely there's a wardrobe that has this, the, you know, like your sort of superhero outfit, like whichever, you know, the thing that will make you go from Clark Kent to Superman. Yes.
I know, because I was wearing it at the time. I was wearing culottes before culottes were probably a thing, but just thinking, why did I wear culottes just because I'm in France? You know that. Oh, just the smile and everything was just, it was just a funny moment. And like your book, in terms of, yes, looking at another woman and wanting to be that other woman just for that moment, which I'm sure lots of women can relate to. So the positive message of saying, you know, you're changing the message, talking about sex, and you want your dream reader to find it sexy and feel uplifted and moved and heard, really, which is what we all want to be seen and heard, don't we?
Absolutely.
So you didn't want your parents to read that one then, but they've probably read The Sisterhood, the love letter that you wrote to women that have shaped you. And you've got five sisters, and you, which is huge. Amazing.
This weekend, all being well, so scared of the jinx, I'm touching wood, I think we're all going to see each other for the first time. I've seen some of them in different places, but this is our first time being all together.
All reunion together. How fabulous. And are you
party has been reorganised about five times.
Are you from Ireland?
No, we're Catholics. So there's definitely, you don't have to go far back to get to Ireland, but we're all
all
over the UK.
Very special, very special. And you wrote about your relationship with your five sisters and comparison. And we've talked about comparison and looking at other women in your book and some of our experiences. And you've mentioned in your TED Talk, Compare and Despair, which I like the title of that, because we're always encouraged, aren't we? But comparison is the road to unhappiness, isn't it? You know, because we never know what people are going through. So whenever we find ourselves starting to compare ourselves or feel envious or feel we just don't know really if they're as happy or as comfortable as we think they are.
It's so true. And it's so easy to forget that. And I, you know, have that conversation with myself every single day. And it's something that I think we all know in our brains, but it's trying to learn it in our hearts. I think it's interesting this last year. And I definitely did this where, you know, I kept counting my blessings and I knew that I had so many blessings.
That really.
But also definitely getting to your point, where I thought, no, this is awful. This is really, really hard. I don't have to qualify that. It's okay. It can be hard for other people and hard for me. Definitely. In a different way. And that's fine. And that's allowed. But no, I think it is so complicated. And I think that whenever, I guess it goes back to, you know, thinking about, you know, that awful time I had at work and the anxiety and really being just so, you know, physically, I was overwhelmed by how dreadful I felt. And I'm really glad that happened, not because I had the last laugh, but because...
Yes. And you've got the coping skills to cope with now.
But I know more than anything how painful it feels to be excluded. And it's such a reminder to never, ever, ever make anyone feel that way, to be about, I just knowing I felt so alone, but that was maybe in a way the least alone I was, because I think that's just such a common human thing. And I think that every time I go through something hard, it does put me in touch with other humans. And I think this is going to sound like I've overdone the CBD all this morning, but every single day,
because this morning,
this is what thrills me as a writer. And I think, oh my gosh, if I'm pleased about something or annoyed about something, I think today people are going to get dumped, people are going to meet the love of their lives and they don't even know it. People are getting
proposed
to, people are getting their dream jobs, people are. People are going to have absolutely awful, awful things happening to them. And in 18 months, they'll say that's the best thing that ever happened. And I'm saying
that's
so true. All of that is going on.
To look at it, because actually nothing is permanent, is it? Nothing is permanent. And I think somebody else I interviewed said, the highs are higher and the lows are lower. And I think that we've just all got to know that that's how we're feeling, to just sit with it, haven't we? And I even say that, to my teens or whatever, how's your mental health today? Are the highs higher or lower? And that's okay, because everyone's talking, aren't they? Which is so important.
Definitely. I think it's just sitting with it. I wish I could remember who said this. I might have to Google it. But something like, all of human unhappiness, everything bad comes from man's inability to sit in a room by themselves. And
really? I think that's true, though, isn't it?
When social media makes me miserable, which it often does, it's not just social media, it's because I'm there, because I'm distracting myself from thoughts. There are lots of things I find myself doing, and it's because I want to be numb and because I'm just not very good at sitting with myself. I'm trying to learn to just be a bit more.
Well, we've had to do that more and think it's okay if we don't go out on a Saturday night or a Friday or whatever, because yes, we could just sit with that. And you're right. And I think that'd be comforting to a lot of people listening. So your passions, what are you passionate about? Writing? Do you ever have any time for anything when you're not writing?
Reading. There's a jump.
Well, going to the beach. So you're near the beach now, aren't you?
I love swimming. I met a friend for lunch yesterday, and in Margate, I said, she's staying in Ramsgate, and I said, oh, meet me by the tidal pool. We've got a really lovely tidal pool right by Walpole Bay, and I should remember when it was built. I think it's either over 100 years old or getting on for 100 years old or 1,000 years old. God, I don't know. But it's really, really spectacular and really good for a swim. There is a smaller tidal pool nearer the main sands, and we're both waiting for each other at different tidal pools. And I feel
Margate.
But the thing I love so much about swimming, and it's been a little while since I've got in the water, I love that. It's probably one of the things that I'm the least good at. I love that I get so much pleasure from something, because I can't really properly, what I do isn't swimming, it's just not drowning.
Flashing
about. It's a doggy paddle.
Yes, it doesn't matter. You're free and you're... It's like being back in the womb, isn't it? Surrounded by water.
But I just think it's so wonderful as someone who has been such an achievement chaser. And I think that as children, quite quickly, we get sort of socialised out of, we don't want to make fools of ourselves. We don't think about things in terms of passion. We just think about things in terms of achievement. And swimming is the opposite of that for me. And that's why I adore it so much. And
I adore it too.
Thanks, guys.
I think it's very meditative, isn't it? And it's very comforting and feels like an indulgence. How lovely to have it on your doorstep. So do you have a mantra for living your life then?
If I have a mantra, I think it's something like always abundance. And I think that when scarcity and anxiety are two things I associate with each other, and I think that I can really feel things like my mental health and self-esteem dropping because I think it's my default to panic that there isn't enough for me, and to sort of hoard, and it has an effect on even things like eating and shopping. And I have really changed my approach to the way I suppose use and abuse certain coping mechanisms in order to be numb and to not sort of sit with thoughts. And definitely if I overeat, it's because there's a little voice going off that's saying, you must do this because you can't do it tomorrow. And that, real feast or famine sense, so the way I work and kind of trying to sort of line up all the work in the world, so I don't have to, it's like I'm always sort of prepping for winter or sort of hoarding, and I don't want to be a practical or emotional hoarder. And I want to believe in abundance. I want to believe that there is enough for everyone. And also, I'm much better at sharing everything I have when I believe there's enough for us all.
Yes.
Because I think it's not... I do go through a phase, definitely on social media, where, and I'm sure, Nikki, you probably have this as well, and it's complicated, where when we try to do work that is, you know, kind and helpful and useful, and you are putting it out into the world, and I think lots of people sort of assume an intimacy with you, and it's a lovely thing, but it's really, really hard to establish boundaries around that and to kind of, you know, make that into a positive thing, but also be able to say kindly and gently, look, everything I have to give you, everything I have to tell you is this, and it's in this book or in this podcast or whatever. And I've never met you, and, you know, I can't meet you for a coffee and then, you know, spend 3 hours doing some sort of entirely unqualified therapy work with you, because I'm not in any position to do that. And I think I definitely gave quite a lot of myself away, stuff that I really couldn't afford to give. And that was a real scarcity mode. I was so frightened of not being liked enough and not liking myself enough. I thought, well, if I don't do what this person's asking, they'll turn away and they'll withdraw and they won't like me anymore. And that'd be awful. And actually having abundance around that as well and say, no, I've given you enough.
That's so true. It's that fear of being judged, isn't it? And I think we're all guilty of that. You know, that wanting to, it's approval, isn't it? And validation, which everyone seeks, you know, children seek, and us adults still do, and particularly in this climate. And I think that's very honest to say to others, you know, that we are good enough the way we are, and we're certainly good enough the way we're coping, just to be coping at all, I think, in this climate, is we're all doing brilliantly.
so true.
Thank you so much for that. And lastly, what key message would you give to people out there to inspire them for future?
That's a very good, very big question. I would like there to be more joy and levity and laughter in life. I know in these times that is quite a big ask, but I just believe so passionately and fervently everything has a funny side. Whatever I write, jokes come out, whether they're funny or not is not for me to judge, but I can't help that. And I think that life is so much more joyful when you seek the fun.
I totally agree with you. And I try and do the same, you know, seek the fun, seek the positive, seek the silver lining, even in the dark times, you know, because it's the only way you get through all this, isn't it? The grass is always helpful. The grass is always greener. So we're hoping we've uplifted everyone. Thank you so much for sharing your amazing life and work and your new filthy funny novel. Good luck with that. And your other one about work. It's been lovely to chat to you. Thanks for inspiring and uplifting us to feel valued, less anxious, and be honest with what we want. The Influential Women's Podcast is founded, hosted, and exec produced by Nikki Bannerman, produced by Safran Mirza. Please contact us to share your views, thoughts on Instagram, and share with others to join our tribe.